ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
For President Donald Trump, there are few more inviting targets than America's universities. Ivy League institutions, including Harvard, Columbia, and the University of Pennsylvania, have lost federal funds and been subject to more direct government control. Now, the administration says it's trying to combat the leftist domination of campus. Philosophy professor Yuval Avnur of Scripps College and two colleagues, Stephanie Maravchek and John Shields, have been especially worried about these attacks. So they began to investigate the allegations of bias in university and college courses. They've published part of their results in the online journal Persuasion.
Probably the most alarming thing that got the three of us talking is just the dismal numbers in the public opinion polls in the U.S. on the level of trust and confidence in higher education, just in the general public. We were really interested in, first of all, figuring out why that is, but also trying to figure out whether some of the common complaints about higher education were true. In the U.S., we're seeing right now what I would describe as an unprecedented attack on institutions of higher education by the current administration. There may be problems in higher education, and they seem to be exploited in the current political climate to do, I'm afraid, some real damage to these institutions that we love. So all three of us are coming from a place of deep respect for the university. We want to protect it. Part of protecting it is seeing where it can be improved, getting real evidence one way or another about what the problem is and how to fix it is the first step towards restoring the public trust in our institutions. In no way do we want or did we plan for our results to fuel the current attack on higher education. In fact, that train left the station long before we even found any of our results.
So let's look at three areas that you examined where you and your co-authors say there's just insufficient debate. It's lopsided. They're the questions of race relations in the US, Israel and Palestine, and the ethics of abortion. Before we go into the findings, briefly tell us about the texts that you looked at and why.
We actually think there is a very healthy debate among scholars on all of these issues. The problem is really whether that debate or how that debate is taught in the classroom. We looked at a number of texts on each of the three issues. On the subject of race and criminal justice, we looked at what is pretty clearly the dominant text on the topic, which is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. This text is assigned in the database of syllabi that we used for our study, just thousands of times. It's really one of the most widely assigned texts in the humanities in general. On the topic of Israel-Palestine, we looked at Edward Said's Orientalism, which actually is not a book about the Israel-Palestine issue. He does go into the Israel-Palestine issue and frames it in a way that has been extremely influential in not only the scholarly discussion that followed Orientalism, the book, but also the rest of the scholarly literature on it. And then on the topic of abortion, it was Judith Thompson's classic essay on the ethics of abortion, which is also by a pretty large margin the most often assigned work. This is an essay, not a book, on the topic of the ethics of abortion.
Let's talk about Michelle Alexander's book first, The New Jim Crow. Sure. She said that after equality legislation was passed in the United States, those seeking to uphold racial discrimination then sought to use the criminal justice system to do that. But it seems to me it was actually some black scholars that pushed back against her, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the first and most prominent voices were other black scholars in the U.S. Foreman Jr. is the one that I believe we discussed in the Persuasion piece. He, of course, is no fan of the criminal justice system, but he claimed that her historical claims were off and the lessons that she's inferred from them were off. And he made a what many saw was a pretty persuasive criticism of the main thrust of her book. Despite this, he is assigned just a fraction of the time when Michelle Alexander's book is assigned. So you see a prominent, certainly I would say left of center, Black scholar, highly cited, works at the Yale Law School, I believe, hardly ever assigned with the dominant text.
There's a statistic that leapt out at me. You said 97% of courses that assign Michelle Alexander's important book, The New Jim Crow, do not include any response from James Forman in his book. James Forman, as you said, of the Yale Law School. They don't include any of his response. What's the consequence of that, Yuval?
One consequence that I find particularly troubling, if we look at what's the consequence for the students who are in these classes, is that they may well come away with the impression that there is a scholarly consensus on this important issue when there isn't. So why is that so important? It's important because the student then goes on into society thinking that anyone who disagrees on this point is just an uneducated ignoramus, and there's no point in, you know, debating with them. It's, you know, hey, look, all of the experts, all the people who are most knowledgeable on this topic already agree, this student will come away thinking. There's no point in debating and engaging in dialogue with those who disagree with it. In this case, that's just not true. There are plenty of extremely knowledgeable people, people who care deeply about the issue too, who disagree with this dominant viewpoint. So that's one bad consequence. And I have to mention another bad consequence of a different sort. This involves the general public. A consequence of not teaching a real scholarly controversy when there is one is that eventually the public learns about it. The public suspects that what we're doing in these classrooms is not representing the reasonable range of views on this important topic. And so they lose trust in the university system. Now, I don't mean to suggest, just to be clear, that the way this particular text is taught is responsible for the lack of trust in higher education, but this kind of approach to teaching in higher education, of which this is a notable example, does contribute to the lack of trust in higher education. And I do think that that directly or indirectly leads to the kind of attack on higher education we're seeing now. It leads to a culture where meaningful debate is stifled or it just doesn't happen because a good chunk of the people who are supposed to be highly educated think that there is a consensus when there is none.
Mm. But there's another point here, though, surely, Yuval, and that is that even if people accept that there's no consensus on a particular text or on a particular argument, I worry that people are conditioned to believe that there should be a consensus and that some topics just are not open to debate. And we don't want to be made uncomfortable by hearing disagreeable opinions. We know the disagreeable opinions exist. We just don't want to be made uncomfortable to hear them.
I think that you are pointing to a real phenomenon that I believe is also a problem. I don't think that what our study shows is that. What our study shows is something about the perspectives that students are getting in their classroom. This has its limitations. I personally think you're right. I would agree with you that there is also increasingly a culture of thinking there should be a consensus because everybody who disagrees with me on topic X, Y, or Z is just immoral, or people shouldn't be raising objections to my view on this topic, whatever the topic is. That is a concern too. I'm not sure I'm prepared to say that our study provided any new or further evidence for that, though. I think that the evidence for that, I would expect it to show up elsewhere, perhaps in online forums and the way that social media is being used and the way that conversations play out in social media and so on.
Here on the Religion and Ethics Report with me, Andrew West, we're speaking with Professor Yuval Avnor of Scripps College, along with his colleagues John Shields and Stephanie Moravcek. He's the author of an analysis about the narrow range of courses and the narrow range of texts that are studied in some American colleges. Let's talk now about Edward Said's book, Orientalism. Not strictly, as you say, just about the Israel-Palestine tension or conflict. It was Said's critique of the way the West viewed the Middle East and non-Western cultures. How widely is it read? But more pointedly, in your study, how widely is it debated? How widely is it contested in classrooms?
There are very few texts in the same category of critical theory or literary criticism that have been as influential as Edward Said's Orientalism. It's an extremely influential book. He was an extremely influential person. It should be assigned. It should be read widely. It's a classic. But how often is he taught with critics of his approach, with critics of the various and many claims that he makes in the book, or just with sort of alternative ways of approaching the topic? We found in our study of syllabi, the answer is really not very often. By far, the texts that you will find co-assigned with Edward Said's Orientalism are fellow travelers. You see a lot of Foucault, you see a lot of Judith Butler, and other critical theory luminaries.
There was a riposte written some years later to Orientalism. It was called Occidentalism. It was by Ian Baruma, who's been on this program a couple of times, and Ivashai Margalit. I mean, it really tried to get a debate going in this field about colonialism. Did that debate ever take off?
In a lot of ways, it did take off in the academic world. We should also mention Bernard Lewis's criticisms of Edward Said. In fact, I think Said and Lewis actually engaged in very widely attended public debate about the topic. And Lewis published his criticisms, of course, subsequently. None of these are taught alongside Edward Said's book, hardly ever at all. Your question, though, was whether their criticisms sparked debate in the field. Absolutely, they did. I think Orientalism has always been contested from a variety of angles, so much so, actually, that the professional association, Middle Eastern Studies Association, there came to be this sort of break-off splinter group who aren't going to take Orientalism as their starting point in studying the Middle East. And they just sort of broke off into their own association of scholars. So on the one hand, yes, the debate about it did play out professionally among scholars, but because scholars tend to silo themselves sometimes into these methodological approaches, if you look narrowly at Middle Eastern studies, you might not find a lot of criticism of the basic approach of Orientalism there. There have been critical papers that we've looked at. They're hardly ever assigned, though.
Yeah, well, fascinatingly, Yuval, maybe surprisingly these days, there were these debates between Edward Said and Bernard Lewis. They were occurring in the New York Review of Books. I have to say today, it's a rather monochrome kind of publication. But the point is, these debates don't reach the ears of students who study Said today.
They're not hearing much criticism. That's, I think, a fact that we can establish looking at the syllabus database. The immediate question is why? Because that sounds like an accusation. It sounds like we are accusing those who teach Said of attempting to indoctrinate students or something like that. I think actually the story is probably more complicated than that. What we found is about a third of the time when Orientalism is taught, it's not taught in a field where the professor is an expert on the topic. So it'll be taught in English departments. He was a literature professor. It is absolutely relevant to the way that you think about literature and art and so forth. So he's often taught in departments and by professors who aren't experts in the field. They might not be aware of the controversy that you and I were just referring to about Edward Said. They might not know anything about Bernard Lewis. They're just assigning this text. As far as it goes, that might be fine. It's just that this text also contains a lot of historical claims, a lot of ideological arguments, and if nowhere else in the curriculum students encounter criticisms of those basic viewpoints, then it becomes a problematic situation where you have a million ways of encountering this very political text throughout the curriculum. You have almost no ways of ever encountering a criticism of it.
Let's deal finally, Yuval, and this was a surprise to me, I have to say, with the famous essay by Judith Thompson, The Defense of Abortion. you actually found that there was a lot more debate in university curriculums about this article. First of all, why was this article so seminal?
It's seminal primarily because it's so brilliant. The thought experiment is so immediately accessible to the student. The argument is at least initially compelling and intuitive. Judith Thompson herself was kind of a force of nature in the field. It's no surprise, really, looking back, I don't think, that it became a classic of philosophy.
But why have professors been more open to providing an alternative viewpoint to this essay? And you have found this, of all the three areas that you studied, you found that there was more openness to debate on the question of abortion. I mean, what's the reason for that?
We don't have any indication of the professors' motives, of the motives of the administrators that oversee these curriculums. But I think in this case, we have a pretty good idea. If you look at the breakdown of what courses a student will encounter this text in, overwhelmingly, it's in philosophy departments. Philosophy as a discipline is kind of all about considering arguments and then considering objections to the arguments. So I think there's kind of a built-in presumption that we're going to debate this already in the very discipline of philosophy. I have to say that not only did we find that people assign alternative views, that is, arguments for the contrary position, pro-life arguments in these classes, whether they engage directly with Judith Thompson or not, we also found that she's often assigned with texts that provide alternative theoretical backgrounds to the one that Judith Thompson appeals to in that essay. So in other words, the impression you get when you look at the patterns in these syllabi is that students who encounter this dominant text, I think it's fair to characterize it as a pro-choice text, will also encounter ideas about morality itself that will help them think critically about her argument, that will help them consider why might someone reject this or that premise of the argument. We find that the text is assigned, for example, with classic works of utilitarianism, which is a theory of morality that arguably runs counter to the kind of considerations that Thompson puts forward in her article. So I think it's because the essay appears in philosophy classes, and I think philosophy classes will tend to be more organized around debates and disputes.
One of the arguments, I guess, that your critics might say is these works by Thompson, by Edward Said, by Alexander, they're unique in their insights. They shouldn't be flattened out by just being melded into some other part of a debate. They stand above all the other texts in the field. You do deal with that criticism. What do you say?
We do, and it's a criticism that we hear a lot. I would begin by conceding something there. These are great texts, so they deserve, arguably, to serve as the anchor for a discussion, for a conversation when you're getting educated about this topic, whatever the topic may be. There's a couple of different versions that it's important to disentangle here, a couple different versions of this objection. On one version, as you say, we shouldn't muddy the waters too much by introducing these critical texts, because these dominant texts, whoever it is, Said or Alexander, they basically got it right, and we need to teach students the truth. There was a philosopher, a thinker not long ago by the name of J.S. Mills on Liberty. He, I think, dealt pretty handily with the view that all we ever need to hear is what we know to be the truth. In the first place, it's pretty arrogant to think that we're infallible on these pretty complicated issues, so infallible that we know that these texts have completed the work of wisdom on the topic. But moreover, there's a lot of value in considering objections to a view, even when you think that the view is true, not only because it helps you to understand and actually know the view that you take to be true by considering objections to it, but because as a student, when you go out into society and you encounter people who disagree with you on these topics, and with these three topics, you will encounter people that you share a society with who disagree with you deeply about these topics, you need to have thought about and thought carefully about their objections, their point of view, and how to critically engage with them. If we take higher education seriously as a sort of training for citizenship and for engagement in civic life, the education needs to include consideration of views that one will encounter in society and in political life, especially when the people who have the most knowledge about it themselves don't agree about it.
Yuval Avnor. He's a professor of philosophy at Scripps College, along with two colleagues, John Shields and Stephanie Moravchik. They've written a paper, Closed Classrooms, an Analysis of College Syllabi on Contentious Issues. We'll put a link to it at our website. There's also a summary at the fascinating online magazine called Persuasion. Yuval, thank you for joining us on the Religion and Ethics Report.
Thank you for considering these important topics on your show.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.